Welcome to the Aaron Werner Podcast on iCode Media. I've got my friend John Rumpakis, Dr. John Rumpakis, with me today, and we had a conversation. We talked quite a bit, but we had a conversation about audits and what we're seeing with audits. And I said, this is a great conversation, I think, that we need to record and share with everyone, because it the A word is one of the least favorite words as a practice owner, as a doctor, that we can hear. And John, given his background and everything he does, is quite knowledgeable in the space. I learn a lot, hope you will too, from the conversation. But before we jump into audits and third-party payers and what they're thinking, John, for those who don't know you, give us a little bit of background.
Sure. I've been involved in this world of coding compliance for a number of years. I've been out in the field for about 40 years now, celebrating that, and really proud to be able to say, we've helped to bring a lot to our colleagues and being able to, join medical plans and how to navigate that and, really provide the care that our patients are looking for and then enhancing our practices at the same time.
So, well, we appreciate it. You told me once that you made a joke that, well, I've got some fiction novels on my nightstand. You've got the Medicare, the Bible's next to your nightstand. So I appreciate that that you enjoy reading those and sharing that information with us.
Yeah, boring and weird, but, necessary.
Necessary. And it's, I look at everything like a game. When you know the rules of the game, you can play the game better. And what I've learned from you and Chris and others is, the rules, while they may not seem super sexy when you're reading the books, they're pretty straightforward for the most part. And yeah, they tell you what the rules are. And it's up to us then to just understand them and play the game appropriately.
Well, I'll tell you, just if I can for a second, I've got a software program that I have for the general physician community. It's called CodeSafePlus.com. And the reason I developed that, Aaron, was specifically for that reason. Back in the late 90s, and even more so today, information changes so fast. It's zip code specific, so it differs based upon where you practice. And if you don't have the knowledge, if you don't have the power of knowing what the rules are, you have no ability to be able to have a discussion with the carrier, let alone prevail on something, because you don't have any basis to do that. And when I developed CodeSafe Plus, it was exactly for that reason, to provide physicians with the power of knowledge in real time in their zip code, so that way they would never feel at a deficit when having that conversation or not knowing what the rules are and providing the care to the patient.
Yep. And fantastic software. It's not why I brought you on to talk about it, but since we brought it up, we've been using it really for the last probably 4 years, 4 or 5 years. Mm-hmm. Left to go back and look. And there was a time when, optometry was fantastic and you could, hang up a sign, you did the right thing, and making money was not hard. And we felt like we were doing the right thing. And it wasn't until I realized what I didn't know and that I didn't have to learn to be an expert in it, I can rely on the experts and engage. Mm-hmm. So between CodeSafe Plus and then the Just Ask John feature, when we do have a mm-hmm. question, has been super beneficial, not only for our doctors, but our medical billers in the practice.
Well, thank you. One of the things is, as you mentioned, is, harder to make money today. And what I want people to focus on is being able to keep the money that they make, right? And so I guess that kind of leads us into the audit, topic a little bit.
Yep. So let's talk about that. The audits, it feels like they're ramping up, post-COVID. I hope we get rid of that phrase soon, but in the post-COVID world, it feels like they're ramping up more. My guess, though, is if we look, it's probably just taking us back to, 2018, 2019 numbers. Why do audits happen? Are they happening because I've been a bad doctor and raised red flags? Are they happening because third-party payers just have to do them and I got unlucky on the draw? What would target it or cause me to get an audit?
Yeah, so there's a number of different reasons that an audit can occur. There's random audits that carriers conduct that has absolutely nothing to do with an individual physician's behavior, with their billing patterns, anything like that. They have to conduct them so that way they can have quality assurance based upon what the protocols are. So many times, you know, you'll get those from a medical carrier. They don't identify any specific records. They don't identify any specific issues. It's just send me these, you know, 10 charts and you really don't hear anything from the carrier again. And I think that's a frustrating thing because carriers, you know, don't get back to you in a timely fashion. And that creates a lot of anxiety in and of itself. Then there's, of course, targeted audits where it is a physician's billing pattern that causes a red flag to go up. So, for example, a high use of a certain CPT code, a high frequency of a particular ICD-10 code, those types of things that then would cause a focused audit where the carrier then would come in and want to look at a specific, you know, subset of records and for particular reasons. I would tell you that if you look at the pass fail rate of those, and I, just for full disclosure, I do work with insurance carriers. I don't perform audits for insurance carriers, but I do evaluate the results and I then help the carrier understand the severity of the issue and then also provide remedial education because, contrary to what most people believe, carriers generally, at least the three or four that I've had the privilege of working with over the years, tend to want to remediate rather than adjudicate punishments right along the way. So if a doctor failed an audit, they don't jump to the 12th level, you know, and you know, assume that it's extremely egregious or anything like that. What they'll do is they'll educate the practitioner. And if they don't see a change in behavior, then, you know, typically penalties and things like that will come into play. So in my experience, doctors have almost always had a chance to be able to remediate things in some fashion, you know, to avoid, you know, monetary, civil or criminal penalties that could come along. But I'd say the number one thing that I see, Aaron, is that it's failure to note medical necessity and doing either, you know, a common behavior that I would say of our peer group is that people will say, hey, I've got all this cool diagnostic equipment. I've got to use it. I know that I've got a covered diagnosis. And, you know, I was doing work with one of the insurance carriers I do work with. And it's interesting that we were looking at glaucoma profiles and individuals that bill glaucoma. The number one diagnosis for that was risk of, you know, primary open angle glaucoma, low risk, and quote unquote pre-glaucoma. And yet you have these diagnoses that are being submitted and, you know, four or five tests every visit that are being done because somebody says, oh, I've got a covered diagnosis and I can run this procedure because I get paid for it. And they think that that reinforcement of getting paid for it sometimes leads people to believe, hey, I must be doing things right because I'm getting paid. Right. And that's not how carriers conduct audits, right? They do post-payment reviews. So they come back and look at you, you know, 1 year, 2 year, 3 years, maybe even 5 years after the event has happened and say, hey, we noticed this behavior and we want to have justification for the dollars we've already paid you. And if you have your medical records set up properly, you should have nothing to worry about. But again, most people don't record medical necessity properly in the record, so they have no justification for what they did. They think if they have a diagnosis and a procedure, that's enough. And it's clearly not enough from medical record keeping rules and guidelines.
So let's break that down a little bit. That's interesting. We'll use the glaucoma suspect or pre-glaucoma. So me diagnosing it and putting the diagnosis in the chart clearly isn't enough. When you say failure to note medical necessity, I would need something additional, an abnormal CD ratio, an optic nerve that right. looks suspicious and detailing why it looks suspicious, something to say why I have that diagnosis and need further testing.
Right. So I typically tell people, you know, when I work with them or, you know, give a lecture, I always say, think about the what, the why, and the when. What do you want the patient to do, right? I want them to have a fundus photo. Why? Noted change in, you know, neural rim thickness in the left eye. When? ASAP or, you know, whenever, today, next week, whatever. So if the doctor typically notes, I want the patient to do this for this reason, you know, because of this finding, then the record's generally bulletproof. But more often than not, people do not do that. They do these battery of tests automatically. They'll say somebody's a glaucoma suspect. And it's funny, in one of these sets of data that I was looking at recently, the vast majority of these tests with those two diagnoses that I was telling you about were for individuals under 50 years of age.
Oh.
And, you know, when you think about the incidence and prevalence of glaucoma and you know the, you know, demographic profile of those, certainly that's not what you would think of, right? The average age in the U.S. is age 54. You know, you start to think about where that falls in the distribution. And, you know, when you start to look at the data that carriers have, it's amazing. Right. And, you know, you have it too. You just, we never look at it in our practices. We never look at our frequencies of procedures and what are we correlating it with. And very few offices actually do self audits where they go in and they look at their records and they say, am I noting medical necessity? Does this actually make sense in what I'm doing and how I'm doing it, the frequency in which I'm doing it? And those are just really common sense questions that many people have difficulty answering because they don't have the material, you know, recorded in their record.
Yeah. Well, that makes sense. We're really telling a story. I had a professor in school say, you're telling a story. And if somebody can follow your story along by reading your notes, then you're generally pretty good. If, you know, all of a sudden something happens in the story and you know, you don't know why, it doesn't make sense why, it ruins the story. And that's where,
that's right,
in this case, questions start getting raised because somebody paid for that.
And they That's right. I use that analogy all the time. And the medical record's like a book, right? It's got an intro, it's got a middle, and it's got a conclusion. And, you know, your office visit, your physical examination and your assessment of the patient is what drives the testing, right? It's what drives the next necessary element. You know, when we go back to the definition of medical necessity, I don't think many people appreciate it for what it should be. I think a lot of people kind of lean towards the side of medically convenient, you know, not necessary. And so when we talk about medical necessity, it really means in the eyes of CMS and third-party carriers is that whatever you're doing, whether it's a test or a surgical procedure or anything like that, it means that that is, you know, indispensable in you needing to diagnose, follow a diagnosis, treat, or follow treatment of a particular condition. We have to get away from doing confirmatory tests, right? Once I know somebody has a particular disease state, I don't need to do 50 other tests to show that, hey, I'm right. They've got that, right? Now I've got it. Now I can use my technology as appropriate in following that diagnosis. Or if I'm treating that patient, I can use the technology appropriately to manage and treat that patient over time. And that's what the rules provide. But when we see, you know, 7 procedures per visit every 3 months for a particular type of diagnosis that you sit there and you go, gosh, I can't find any practice patterns like that that would be substantiated either by the Academy of Ophthalmology's preferred practice guidelines or the American Optometric Association's clinical practice guidelines. If I can't find anything to substantiate that kind of frequency, that's when a carrier starts to say, hey, what's going on? Why are you seeing these people this frequently and why are you doing this much testing? And they generally will ask it as a question. Please explain why these records, why you're doing this and from this subset of records. And that's really what an audit is. An audit is, you know, think about it with the IRS. The IRS is going to come in and say, show us your receipts for these, you know, expenses that you're deducting. And an insurance carrier does the same thing. Show us your medical records that substantiate what we've already paid you for, because we trusted that what you were submitting was true and honest and accurate, just like it says on your, you know, submission form. So.
Yeah. Sounds a lot like trust, but verify. And
right. Which is that's exactly what it is.
Pretty American concept. The
true.
Trust and verify. You mentioned, that, you know, practice patterns. And so when I hear that, there's the guidelines, but because they have the data, they also can compare me to my colleagues, other optometry, mm-hmm. other eye care, and they can say, hey, Aaron, maybe, you know, you're diagnosing glaucoma higher than we're seeing elsewhere. You're running more, you know, OCTs, fundus photos, more than we're seeing elsewhere. The doesn't mean I'm doing something wrong per se, but it's when they're comparing me to my colleagues, how do they look at that? Are they looking for outliers? Are they just trying to find red flags? Is it bad that I'm an outlier? Maybe I've got a full justification because I have a glaucoma practice, and so mm-hmm. It makes sense that I would. How do they view it in their standpoint when they're comparing me?
Great question. So I think that at first, you know, everybody is looking for outliers. Who's doing a higher than normal number of procedures based upon a percentage or frequency basis? So, you know, ICD-10 codes and, you know, procedure codes, those are what they typically look for. Now, I'm going to digress for 2 seconds into the ICD-10. So when the ICD-10 got implemented back in October 1st of 2015, what many people don't realize, and if you go back and you do the research, the ICD-10 was designed specifically to help to develop public health policies. So government-provided health, right? Universal health care. That's what the ICD-10s were designed for, because remember, with the addition of specificity of laterality and severity, now they could start to put things together. They can say, okay, I've got primary open angle glaucoma, moderate severity, bilateral, and now I can take that specific ICD-10 code and look across an entire spectrum of providers, and I can monetize that, right? I can say on average, it takes $600 a year to manage that patient from a, you know, OCT, visual field, photo, whatever procedure else you like to do for that, you know, on what it's going to cost. But it also helps to establish utilization guidelines, right? How many of these procedures should be in place and what do we follow and how do we follow that? And so let's say you had a glaucoma specialty practice and you happen to get audited. One of the very first things that you should do, and you're entitled to do under your contract, or I should say at least most contracts that I've read, if you're a subspecialist, you're naturally going to have a much higher level of special procedures per, you know, group of patients, 10,000 patients or whatever it's going to be. So one of the things that you need to do is you need to be able to articulate to the carrier is that I want to be compared against a, you know, comparison basis of my peer group. Now, my peer group is not all of optometry. My peer group is ophthalmologists and optometrists that specialize in glaucoma, because you can tell that the frequency of those tests is going to be vastly different between a practice that doesn't do anything and a practice that does solely that specialty. And so if you want to truly be compared against your peer group, you have to properly define what your peer group is. And that's, you know, that's generally a right that you have underneath it, under your contract, that you need to invoke or at least communicate to the carrier if it gets to that, you know, if it gets to that stage.
Well, that makes sense. And so it sounds like a lot like the audit is really just the beginning of a conversation. Right. And
that's how I view it. I mean, listen, I get calls at all times of the day. People call me up and they go, God, you got to help me. And I'm like going, okay, what's going on? I got a letter from a carrier. Okay. Tell me what it says. Well, I don't know, but they're coming after me. I said, okay, step away from the ledge. Let's, you know, break it down. Yeah. And by and large, I mean, I'll tell you, for example, there's one carrier right now across the country that's sending out general letters that are saying to everybody, your billing frequency of 99213 threes and 214s is too high, right? There's no basis for it, right? They don't say based upon coding for medical decision-making or coding based on time. They just say your frequency of these is too high. And so the question that I always have people ask back is, too high is compared to what? With the changes in 2021 with the E&M codes, mm-hmm. it is absolutely for most individuals like yourself or who have a disease-based you know, practice in addition to, you know, traditional vision care, you're going to have a much higher percentages of level fours than you used to have, because the criteria changed for the medical decision-making now that allowed us to have new patients at level fours, as well as established patients at level fours, where as a previous system, it was very difficult to hit a new patient level four, 99204 versus a 1-4. And so you're going to see those percentages go up just by definition of the change in the rule. And the time rules themselves changed everything as well. I mean, in fact, to an extent that Medicare didn't know what the heck hit them, the incidence rate of 992X5s, the level fives, based upon time, went up significantly after that rule was implemented. And they came out with a, you know, watch statement, hey, you know, we're going to be really investigating this, make sure you're tracking your time appropriately, so that way it's, you know, it's going to be defendable, but we're going to crack down on that and we're going to make that a known issue. So, but yeah, it's really funny. I think a lot of people panic. They don't know what the issues are and they start to, you know, kind of reach out to somebody and say, hey, you know, you got to help me. And most of these things turn out to be pretty benign. You know, thank God. I mean, in my 40 years, I think I could probably still count on two hands the cases of actual fraud I've been involved with. And the ones that I've been involved with have been pretty blatant and, you know, pretty hard to defend. And, but most of the time we fall into the category of what we call waste and abuse. It's just overdoing things. We're not having the appropriate justification in the medical record to do it. And, you know, I think part of it is our education process. We go to these great educational conferences. I mean, Lord knows we've got fantastic technology. I'm just blown away at the pace at which technology is developed. And we can't wait to get that into our practice, right? Because everybody likes their toys, right? I mean, it really helps you. I mean, I'm sure that when you put in new technology, you communicate to your patients that maybe you're the first in the region to have it and you're excited and this is what it does and the great care it can, you know, help you deliver by diagnosing more early in this, you know, whatever it may be. But I don't think people pay a lot of attention to the protocols of where does that come in. You know, when I think about dry eye, which has been a huge subspecialty topic for the last 5, 6, 7 years, right? Really starting to ramp up and get people involved. You know, the carriers, what do they use as their reference sources? They typically use, like, they're going to go to the DEWS report, and then the DEWS 2, and then the various iterations of it. And they're going to go in and they're going to say, you know, for example, if you do, let's say you do a extremely high number of amniotic membranes because you feel that that's the very best therapy for a patient to do that. Listen, if you think it's the best therapy, there's absolutely no problem at all with you doing it on every person that you think it's the best therapy for. But if you're getting paid with somebody else's dollars, i.e. a third-party carrier, you've got to follow their rules on when you can implement that therapy. If you want to charge your patients for it, knock yourself out. You know, you can do that. But if you're a covered provider and the patient wants you to submit a claim, you then have to follow those rules. Well, if I look at where I fall in the dues, you know, I don't fall in at dues one. I don't even fall in at dues two with an amniotic membrane for ocular surface disease, right? I fall in a little bit later. And so that's what they use, and that's what they're going to look at evidence in the medical record to say, hey, I tried this therapy, it failed. I tried this therapy, it failed. I tried this therapy, it failed. And now I'm to this next therapy. Yeah. And, you know, so we have to be knowledgeable of that side of things as well, not just the cool tech and, hey, I've got a covered diagnosis.
Yeah. Well, you made two really good points that set with me. The first is that, you know, we can really do whatever we want, probably isn't the right word, whatever we feel is necessary. And in dry eye is a perfect example. We do quite a bit of IPL and LipiFlow, and I don't have a third party payer that will pay for any of that, but we tell the patient we think it's necessary. And their first question is, does insurance cover it? And we smile happily because we know it's a cash pay procedure and say, absolutely not. But I still think you really need it. It'll make a difference for you. So I find it interesting that depending on the diagnosis and what we're treating, sometimes we taper the diagnosis strictly or the treatment based upon whether a third party payer will pay for it or not, where other times we're happy to go outside of that, which saying it out loud sounds really silly because, you know, why are we letting a third party person dictate what our best recommendations are? I think it certainly right. factors in if there's a, you know, who's paying for it, but I think we need to put everything on the table. At the same token, you know, just because somebody gave us a rep, gave us a list of, you know, things we can bill for and how we can get paid, doesn't mean we're, you know, yeah. we should use it every time.
Yeah, I could tell you, I mean, as much as I enjoy, I do a lot of work with a lot of different manufacturers as a reimbursement consultant in our space. And I really enjoy that work. And I still would tell you that a third party manufacturer is generally not one that should be giving billing advice. You know, most of the third party carrier or third party manufacturers that I work with, you know, they want to hire somebody like me that'll give them an opinion of what that is, but that's my specialty area. It's not the manufacturer's responsibility to do that. And, you know, when they declare and here's how I would say it in what you said, as far as it's a cash pay procedure. If it's a non-covered procedure, yep. right, it's non-covered. So therefore, the carrier doesn't provide any guidance on what they're doing. They say it's either experimental or investigational, or I'm sorry, this falls out of our window of covered therapies. Then, you know, what you do is you use the same code, the same fee as you would bill the carrier. You're just billing the party that's responsible for it. And, you know, I kind of try to help people understand insurance in a little different way. I try to explain that insurance is nothing more than payment assistance. Right. I mean, if you really think about it, and the beauty about the U.S. healthcare system, despite all of its faults that we have, I always tell people it pays 100% of the time for 100% of what we do. Doesn't pay 100% of what we charge, but it pays, you know, you're going to get paid 100% of the time. And if you ever, you know, as a tip to your listeners, if you go back into your accounts receivable and things like that, and you look at your billing records, and if you find that you've ever written a claim down to zero, that means that somebody in your practice didn't do their job, whether it's the doctor, the tech, the front office, whatever. Because if you use an ABN or a waiver of financial liability appropriately in your practice, and you inform the patient that this is non-covered, or that you suspect that it's non-covered for a specific reason, then you're allowed to make sure that you get paid by the patient. And I think that I see a lot of fear in our peer group that, you know, it's funny, they don't mind charging for these, right? They're $1,000. They've got the greatest progressive lens, AR, great frame, and you need three pair of them, you know. But if I have to charge $2,000 for an amniotic membrane or whatever the fee is that you charge, I think they have a hard time justifying to tell a patient, this is the best therapy for you. This is miraculous. It's going to take care of your condition. It costs $2,000. And I think we have to be able to mentally get over that hump and understand that there's 50,000 practitioners to take care of 330 million people. What we do is really special. Our intellectual property, and you've heard me say this before, is really unique, right? And being able to bring relief to a patient through a great technology, whatever it may be, that's cool. Yeah. We should not be making financial decisions for patients. We should be treating everybody equally without bias or discrimination, apply our therapy appropriately to, you know, our diagnostic ability and therapy to every patient. And if a patient happens to have payment assistance that you're a participating provider with, then follow the rules of getting paid with that payment assistance. You know, I mean, that's kind of how I like to break it down. It doesn't have to be complicated.
No, that makes perfect sense. I like that payment assistance. I had this conversation with my daughter this morning. She's going out with her friends, and I said, you see a movie? I said, cool, here's money for movie, the movie ticket and popcorn. You want anything else? That comes out of your pocket. Right? I'm not saying you can't have it, right? I'm just saying this is what I'm paying for. And
that's exactly right.
So very similar. And you held up a pair of glasses for those who aren't watching when you said we don't have a problem charging for these. I'll take it a step further and let me know if you agree. You know, quite frankly, we have, hey, here's good, better, best, or better, best, you know. So in the case of an amniotic membrane, you know, this is what I believe that you need. I think it's the absolute best. It costs $2,000. the it's not covered under your insurance. That's the next question. But it's what I believe you need. If a patient comes back and says, I just can't afford that, that doesn't mean that it's, in my world, all or nothing. There's a not as good, but a good, you know, still therapies that we can address. It just may not be the best. So I think that the choice and that discussion is an important part of the doctor-patient relationship.
And right.
I made the comment earlier, it's funny how sometimes we dictate our decisions based upon whether a third-party payer is going to pay for it or not, or going to cover it or not,
right,
as opposed to putting all the options on the table. And I like how you phrase that with a payment assistance. This year, we proudly introduced the Life Meter to our practice in response to our staff's passionate demand for enhanced patient care. Their firsthand experience with the Life Meter underscored the crucial link between proper diet, carotenoid supplementation, and visual health and performance. Our front desk team now measures every patient's skin carotenoid levels, providing valuable education on each score and the significance of carotenoids in ocular performance and health. The result? Patients love the enhanced experience, and our MacuHealth sales have doubled since implementing Life Meter. To discover more, contact your MacuHealth representative or click on the link in the show notes. As doctors of optometry, we cannot do what we do without our team. And para-optometrics are allied health professionals who assist us in providing the highest level of vision care to our patients. We at iCode Education want to support you and your team in the para-optometric certification process, which is why not only do we have resources available, training resources available for your team to help prepare them for the test, but we also have a discount code specifically for the Aaron Werner podcast listeners, which gives you $100 off for 12 months. So you can use the code AWP2024, that's AWP2024, to get $100 off for a 12-month code. We'll put the link in the show notes, but you can visit iCodeEducation.com and search for para-optometric training to see what those courses are like.
Yeah. I mean, I guess it goes back, Aaron. I mean, I think about where we've come. You know, it used to be described so much as we want, you know, practices want to follow the medical model or not. And I look at that term and I just think, oh my God, it just puts us in a bucket that we don't want to be in. I look at your practice as being the eye care model. Forget the medical model, non-medical model. You're the eye care model, right? You treat everything from myopia to presbyopia to glaucoma to MACD, whatever it may be. That's what you do, right? Your job is to diagnose and treat or diagnose and refer. That's your choice, right? Yeah. But there shouldn't be anything that's wrong with telling Mrs. Smith, who comes in that's 58 years old, 60 years old, and says, you know, I've diagnosed today, you're myopic, astigmatic, presbyopic, you've got beginning signs of macular degeneration and ocular surface disease. My plan is this. I'm going to recommend glasses and or contact lenses for your myopia, astigmatism, and presbyopia. We're going to do some additional testing of the retina for your macular degeneration, and we're going to schedule you for a workup for your ocular surface disease. I don't care who's paying for anything. Those are my diagnoses and those are my recommendations. Now I can work with the patient on what do they want to pursue and how, you know, we need to start prioritizing those based upon severity. But so many times we limit our care based upon the patient's coverage. Mm-hmm. And we shouldn't do that, right? I mean, it just doesn't seem that, you know, it's appropriate from a medical, ethical, legal perspective. My job is to take care of that patient and make them aware of all of their problems that I found and diagnosed and what my recommendations are. Whether they want to follow my recommendations is up to them and how compelling I am in my explanation to them.
Yep.
Right?
Yep. No, I agree 100%. I think the biggest challenge is the money talk. And in all my work with colleagues, looking in the mirror myself, that's the least comfortable part of the entire patient interaction is the money talk. And I think it's just inherent in who we are and maybe why we even chose optometry. But we want to care so much for people that making them uncomfortable makes us uncomfortable.
But I think we have to understand also that most of the consumers out there who have insurance for their medical, I'm talking about their medical insurance specifically, don't really have a say in what it is. Their employers pick out a plan, right? And they pick out levels of coverage and they see this is your stated benefit. I mean, and if the employer picks a plan that has a $3,500 deductible or a $7,000 deductible or a $10,000 deductible, that's not the consumer's fault, no. Right? Or it is, if they choose their own insurance, they've decided I can only afford a $5,000 deductible or a, you know, $2,000 deductible. What we have to understand is the payment assistance that they come in with has nothing to do with our diagnoses and treatment recommendations. It is what it is. They presented with that level of payment assistance. My job is to diagnose and treat or diagnose and refer, and then make sure that I'm working with them with whatever level of payment assistance that they have to make them understand that. By the way, they also know that they've got a $5,000 deductible, yeah, right?
It's not a surprise to them.
And it is a difficult conversation because most of the care today that we provide, for outpatient services comes under the deductible. I mean, most people don't reach their deductible unless there was a catastrophic issue or something like that. So we have to understand that most of the procedures that we're going to do are covered services, but subject to the deductible, meaning still paid for by the patient. And I think that that's hard for optometrists to wrap their head around, not from a conceptual standpoint, just from a management standpoint, right? I have to instruct my staff, how do we talk about it? Did we go through all the consistent steps? Did we pre-authorize? Did we not? Did we get verification of benefits? I mean, it takes a lot of administrative load to make sure we're doing things correctly, right? I mean, and coding is one of those components, but it's also the application of all of this other type of administrative things that makes it, you know, difficult. And I kind of laugh because I know that a lot of people, you know, are using outside billing services for their practices now. And I think that there's some really good ones out there. But what people have to understand is the doctor is still responsible for doing the coding. They still have to make sure that their medical record is pristine and perfect and has all the components in it, and choosing the correct and accurate diagnosis and the correct and accurate procedure code, not something close to or anything like that. But everything has to be, you know, pretty precise. And that still lies within the doctor's duties, not a third-party billing company, because they're just following. That's why it's called revenue cycle management. They're just, you know, managing the money flow and submitting the claim and making sure that they track it properly.
Yep. That makes sense. And I will share, in fact, I just submitted an article for Review of Optometry Business. Because I, 2018, 2019, I realized that I felt like a fish out of water in this space, and we'd never failed an audit. But I was still, my heart skipped a beat when we got those letters, and it was, you know, I felt more comfortable when we had paper charts that I could go back and double check everything on electronic records. You know, what it was is what it was. And I didn't want to feel that way. And so, we hired, Chris to come in, and I know you do this as well. We hired him to come in and audit us. I said, hey, just audit me. I'm not going to pick the charts. I want you to pick them. I just tell me where I'm at. And I was scared to death to, you know, let a colleague see behind the curtain. Mm-hmm. And what we found was that really we were doing most things pretty darn well. To your point, we had some improvements to do in the noting medical necessity. It was, you could read between the lines and find it, but, you know, he kind of just said, hey, you know, dum-dums, just write it out. You know, it doesn't need to be an essay. Just say, I see this, I'm doing this, you know. For more, a super simple sentence. And then the bigger part was at that point was, you know, just be proud of yourselves, you know, stop undercoding, hoping to avoid the spotlight. Just be proud of the work you're doing, because here's how much money you left on the table. And you did the work. You just undervalued yourself. Stop it. Right.
Undercoding has been endemic for quite a while. I've seen it taper off, you know, more probably within the last 8-10 years. I don't think it's as big of a problem. You know, I do audits all the time for offices, you know, and I typically start with probably 15 to 20 records, not a huge amount. We always do randomized samples, you know, those types of things. And then if I see a area or a pattern develop or something, we may do more, you know, and that sort of thing. One of the things I'll tell you is I think that the modern day electronic health record that we work with aren't always perfect either. There's never really perfect spots to write things down. I find that on special ophthalmic procedures, the interpretation and report is very limited. It's like test done, right eye, left eye, impression, okay, you know, and that's not an adequate interpretation report. So I find that there's, you know, limitations that occur because of the EHR. And I think that any experienced auditor would tell you that there's no perfect EHR out there to do things. However, one of the things I always tell doctors to do is print out your actual record. Do it. Print 10 records a month and read through it and see if that actually makes sense. We were talking about the book analogy earlier. Make sure your medical record reads like a book. There are electronic health record systems out there that when I see the printouts, they have conflicting information in it. Patient was dilated, no dilated exam performed. Patient had retinal vascular disease, no retinal vascular disease found. I mean, all inconsistencies throughout the entire medical record. And when I'm an auditor, you know, when I'm in audit mode, I have to read this and understand that I'm reading it because I'm an eye care professional, right? Yeah. Most auditors are not. They could be nurses, nurse practitioners, you know, other people that are coding experts that are, you know, CPCs that are trained to look for things, but they're not going to read between the lines, right? They're going to say, it's present, it's not present. It's present, it's not present. And doctor, where is it in here? Or you have contradicting information. So what is true? And, you know, you normally try to look for patterns and things. You know, I look for intent. You know, I will tell you that a lot of times, you know, and I mentioned the handful of individuals where I've detected true fraud. I'm telling you, you read the record, an inexperienced eye, but somebody who is an eye care professional could clearly see that somebody was doing something with the intent of defrauding. I mean, that you would get from point A and you and I and 98% of our peers would go, oh yeah, point A, point B, point C, point D. And the record that you're reading goes from point A to point R. And you're like going, how did you get there?
Yeah.
There's no path. And it's just very, you know, very evident. But I would say there's a lot of preventive things that people can do. I mean, self-auditing, I think, is great. One of the things I tell doctors if they're in group practices, because then you don't have to worry about HIPAA and all of that sort of thing. Aaron, if you and I and let's say Chris were in a practice together, I'd say once a month, I'm going to review 5 of your records. You're going to review 5 of Chris's and he's going to review 5 of mine. And we're going to sit down and we're going to go through them. What did I do wrong? What was deficient? Did I explain it correctly? And you would be amazed at just the self-learning that takes place. If you look at a colleague's record, you can, because they don't write in the same style you do. No. You're forced to follow their train of thought based upon what they wrote. So self-auditing is really important. Making sure that you look at your EOBs before they're, or your claim forms before they're submitted to ensure that your billing staff is doing it properly. If you're using an outside biller, ask them for a report to make sure that you can tell the medical record and the claim form being submitted with your NPI is making sure that everything jives.
Yep.
And then making sure that your fees are being charged equally amongst all patient groups. I mean, there's a number of different things that you can do proactively to improve yourself. You don't necessarily need somebody like me. Somebody like me is really good to help to identify issues and to help put you on a corrective path. But if I do my job right, you don't need me for a long time. You might need my software because the rules change all the time.
Right.
But me, you don't need all the time. And I think that's really important because I think a lot of ODs think this is so above me. I don't understand it and all of that stuff. It doesn't have to be really hard. If you put yourself through, and I literally mean this, 2 weeks of training to get your office visit levels right. Understand how to create your medical record to show medical necessity. Make sure your INRs are written properly. Man, you're going to solve 90% of your problems by doing preventive things. And I think that that's, you know, if I had to give anybody any positive advice, don't be afraid of it, right? I mean, this is something that you do daily, 20, 50, you know, 20, 30, 40, 50 times a day. And depending on how many patients you see, get on top of it, get ahead of it, right? And yep. And don't shirk back and be afraid of it.
Nope. I very well put. That's that was 100% my experience. And the first time we did it, honestly, we paid to have it done because I didn't feel like I knew what I was doing. It had been on my to-do list for way too long. I said, I'm going to pay a professional to come do it. We had well over a 20 times return on the expense.
Mm-hmm. Oh,
well
yeah.
Over it's, that. I mean, plus being able to sleep at night. Right. But it just from a dollar number, it was an immediate return. And now that number shrunk. So every couple of years we do it again,
sure,
just to verify. And we're refining the process. We're starting to get into now tracking, you know, prevalence rates. And are we catching everything that we would expect to catch based upon published prevalence rates, which gets even more fun and more exciting. We're no longer afraid of that audit because I'm good. You know, take a look at the charts. Yeah. I'm proud of them.
Well, I think that any good auditor will... It's an education process, right? What I would do is I go through, and you and I would sit down with the records simultaneously, and they say, let's go through this section. Let's go through the, you know, intake section. You know, I'll tell you something. It's kind of funny. So I just did an audit on a practice. We looked at roughly 25 charts, and it was a managed vision care carrier audit. Okay. And I was looking through the records, and the practitioner failed 98% of the records for submitting a comprehensive eye exam, 920X4 and a 920X15 refraction. Why did they fail? They failed to include confrontation fields, motilities, pupils, right, in doing things. And so they had no record of those in the record at all, anywhere. And so it didn't meet the requirement, the definition of a 920X4. And the practitioner said, well, we do it, but we do it on everybody. And I said, I believe you.
Yeah.
But are you filling out the place in the record, or are you indicating the checkbox or whatever your EHR allows to demonstrate that you did it? And, you know, it's simple things like that. And I think that most people like you, when you sat down with Chris, if I walk you through the record, your very first thing you're going to come away with is, I'm doing pretty good. There's not a lot of mistakes. I need maybe to change five things or enhance five things. And I would tell you that by and large, for all the records I audit every year, when I have that discussion with the practitioners, like you said, my shoulders go down, you know, their shoulders go down, they can sleep at night, and they really realize they're not doing too bad of a job, but there are four or five things that really do need their attention and remediation on. And like I said, in my experience, it's medical necessity for both the procedures that we're doing and medical necessity for the level of visit that we're billing. And if we can get those two things done, I would tell you that your chances of failing an audit drop dramatically. It doesn't mean you're not going to get audited. It just means that you're going to be able to have a bulletproof medical record that you can go to an auditor and say, here you go. I mean, this is why I build this. And here it is in writing. There's my logic on that day 3 years ago that I don't remember, but it's memorialized right there.
Right there. Yep. My experience has been exactly what you said. And, you know, if I'm a professional athlete or a singer or whatnot, you know, we do our trade really well. There's just a few little tweaks that we can make to make ourselves that much better.
And, yeah. I mean, we also have to audit. We have to remember that insurance carriers aren't necessarily out to get us. All they're really doing is trying to identify, is there an aberrant behavior? Is it malicious? Is it not malicious? They have to do quality control on the amounts that they're paying out. Remember, most of these companies are publicly traded companies. They have a P&L. Doesn't mean that they are, you know, looking at the P&L daily, but they have to look at quality of care. We can't continue to, you know, pay for pre-glaucoma, you know, five tests every visit if that doesn't make sense with what the scientific or medical literature substantiates, right? Yeah. I mean, So it's a process of checks and balances. They're not out to get us. They just want to make sure that we're following the rules, you know, in order for us to earn the dollars that we've contracted to get paid. And we're providing quality care that's defendable, and it's the standard of care in our local community, right? Yeah.
Well, and I think that's very appropriate, right? They're being stewards of somebody's money, right? And so they're tasked with using it appropriately, not being cheap with it, just using it appropriately. And I think as providers of care, we're tasked with also being responsible with how we use time and resources.
Yeah. Well, I also think if we eliminate a lot of the payments that are going out for care that may be not necessary, that leaves more money in the budget technically for those individuals who truly need the care, you know, as well. And just that alone may help, you know, could help reimbursements go up and, you know, those other types of things that we always discuss.
Oh, definitely. Well, John, this has been really insightful and helpful, and maybe not make me want to wrap my arms around third-party payers and give them a big warm I love you hug, but certainly understanding the process, their role, and not being so afraid of the audit monster when they send that letter.
I really appreciate being here. It's been a great conversation, and I hope that, you know, those individuals that are watching or listening, they can understand that this is something that is controllable, right? This is something clearly within your wheelhouse and within your power to eliminate the fear, be proactive about, and, you know, really come out and on the right side of things.
Yep, absolutely. And we'll put links in the show notes to your CodeSafe Plus product and contact if somebody does want to reach out and have that audit. I strongly recommend doing it. It's you know, it's a scary process the first time, but after that you realize that, you know, you can breathe. You're doing the right things, you're probably just not, you know, valuing yourself enough, and so you can, can certainly get a strong return on that and be able to sleep a little bit better at night.
Absolutely.
Awesome. Thanks, John.
Thank you, Aaron. Have a great day.